So to Syria now. Yesterday we heard a discussion of the chess game taking place at the United Nations and elsewhere, where apparently the regime in Syria has signed on to a program of military withdrawal in exchange for a drop in a demand by the West for regime change in Syria, something that satisfies, or at least tacitly seems to satisfy, the concerns of Russia and China, who vetoed Security Council resolutions. Syrian government says it's begun pulling troops out from some cities ahead of next week's self-imposed deadline to implement International Envoy Kofi Annan's truce plan. But as often is the case with the Syrian regime, the words may not match the actions on the ground, and U.S. diplomats have already expressed some skepticism. Joining us now is Jim Muir, correspondent for our partner, the BBC. Jim, what are we seeing at this point?
What we're seeing really is quite a lot more violence. In fact, the death count for the past 24 hours is, depending on which you choose to believe, 70, 80, round about that kind of level. In the various parts of the country, Idlib province in the northwest near the Turkish border, Homs especially in the center, which is still being heavily pounded by artillery, and down around Dara in the far south, where there's a lot of activity going on too. So the impression is that although there are reports which I certainly can't confirm and which are not officially announced or signaled by the Syrian regime, there are reports that they have begun withdrawing from some areas. In other areas, the trouble spots, it seems in fact that if anything, they're actually redoubling their activity, perhaps to try and get things finished or deal as many blows as possible before the deadline expires on Tuesday for them to halt all such violent actions and start pulling military out of built-up areas.
Given, Jim, you're the persistence of the violence that you've just described there and the persistence of the opposition in some of the cities that you cited, if they actually do stick with this deadline and pull out, will we be seeing, in effect, the deconstruction of Syria, that Bashar al-Assad will be holding Damascus and not much more in the populated centers around the country?
Well, that's kind of quite hard to believe or to envisage, and that's why I think there's such widespread skepticism about the Syrian government actually going through with everything it has supposedly pledged to do. Now, what activists are hoping is that the troops will pull out of places like Homs, Hama, Idlib, Dara, and so on, which, as you suggest, would leave basically Aleppo in the north and Damascus in the center as the two main citadels of government power. And what the activists are hoping is that the streets will then be flooded by the regime's opponents. Now, whether the regime will allow that to happen, it remains to be seen. They're very wary of this whole process because when there was the Arab League plan back like December, January, they pulled out of some areas and they were then the vacuum was promptly filled by armed opposition people who took over entire quarters in places like Homs. So that's why there is such skepticism about this plan actually being followed through.
At the very least, this deadline that's coming up next week will be a test both of the opposition and of the intentions of the Syrian government. Jim Muir, correspondent for our partner, the BBC, thanks so much.
Very welcome.
So the use of social media, GPS, and mapping software to monitor fleets of, say, UPS trucks, to track the spread of viruses and disease, to track foodborne contamination, these tools have been with us for a few years now. And the use of social media to mobilize crowds of protesters, to document government atrocities and spread the word, these tools have been features of the unrest in the Arab Spring movement, and we've seen that in Syria already. But now a combination of the two has been launched in Syria to track and document the incidents of sexual abuse and violence against women in that country. Lauren Wolf joins us now, director of Women Under Siege, which is a web-based project that uses crowdsourced data of violence against women within Syria's borders to create a live map where violence has occurred and is most prevalent and that can be observed by humanitarian watchers and workers. Lauren Wolf, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good morning.
How does this tool work and what does it supplement? What kind of information does it supplement to better aid the humanitarian situation in Syria?
Well, the way it works is that people can submit to the Women Under Siege Syria.crowdmap.com site by sending an email entirely anonymously or submitting directly to the site. You can also submit via a hashtag, Rape in Syria, and every report is hand approved by the team that I work with, which includes a doctor at Harvard who is our partner on this, named Dr. Catherine Mullally, a team of epidemiologists at Columbia, and Syrian activists. So basically, we're using our medical and journalistic judgment to really weigh each report to determine if it belongs on the site. Because as you know, and as Jim was just saying, it sort of depends who you believe in this situation.
Well, yeah, and that, of course, is always a complication in cases of sexual abuse. But in this particular case, what kind of data are you evaluating? I suspect you're getting reports second and third hand, or do you have people in Syria who are giving you closer to firsthand reports?
That's right. They're mostly second and third hand. It's really way too dangerous right now to be working directly in Syria. I've had people contact me asking, you know, saying they'd like to help. They're doctors inside Syria who are tracking sexual abuse. But it's really too dangerous for them to be siphoning that information out. So we're trying to figure out safe ways to do that. So right now, a lot of our reports are coming from activists who've heard these things secondhand. And as you just pointed out, determining whether rape actually happened is probably one of the hardest things you can do in the eyes of the world, regardless. So combine that with the difficult reporting situation that's basically a black hole in Syria, and we have a really difficult task right now.
Although what you find when you begin to aggregate data and allow using certain kinds of software tools and crowdsourced techniques, that if you aggregate it and map it, you can begin to see patterns that maybe weren't clear in the individual data points themselves. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there's a way to answer the question, is the sexual abuse you're seeing in Syria on an uptrend? Is it a result of just the general chaos in the country, or is it a weapon that the government is using against women specifically?
Right. I don't know if I can talk about whether it's gone up since the war, because I'm pretty sure there's no reliable data of rape in Syria before the war. Maybe I'm wrong, but it's not the kind of thing that a lot of countries are keeping track of anyway. And then in a war zone situation at Women Under Siege, it's a women's media project that was started by Gloria Steinem, actually. And the reason it was started was to keep track of how weapon is used specifically, rape is used specifically as a weapon of war. So if we can figure out the motives, you know, is it being used to gain information of an opposing force? Is it being used to humiliate women and their husbands and their families? Maybe we can start to learn why it's happening so we can put a stop to it.
Go ahead. And precisely these patterns were seen in Bosnia and other places that these sorts of techniques were used, even if the internet tools weren't as well developed.
Right. And the difference now is because, like you said, we can take a look at the bigger picture on a map. Perhaps we can target where women are suffering the most and send in some kind of survivor services, perhaps to a camp in Turkey where survivors are living.
Taking a look at patterns of sexual abuse in the unrest in Syria, that's Lauren Wolf, director of Women Under Siege. Thanks so much, Lauren.
Thank you.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.